I've often wondered when I read the Christmas narratives, what must it have been like to raise the Son of God? And the frustrating thing is that the Bible is nearly silent on the matter. So silent that during the early Christian era, people wrote out those stories in what were apocryphal gospels. One of which is called the Gospel of Thomas is a well-known one where a toddler Jesus is playing. In the mud and makes little birds out of clay and then breathes on them and they fly away, which is a delightful little story. The not so delightful one is where he's having a fight with friends, as kids do, and he curses one and he dies on the spot, and Mary finds out and yells at Jesus and he brings him back to life. And so there are lots of funky little stories from the first few centuries of the Christian era, trying to fill in those blank spots because we have so little in Scripture. Mark's gospel is just in too big a hurry to mention any of the birth stuff. Jesus just shows up 33 years old at the Jordan saying, "Hey, do me." John's gospel is so into his philosophy of word made flesh and light shining in the darkness that the daily reality of a baby whose scalp smells of mother's milk and fresh baked bread just doesn't enter into it. He doesn't have a vocabulary for sleepless nights and pukey shoulders and scraping diapers. Even the Son of God poops. Matthew's gospel keeps us breathless with this poor refugee couple who are on the run in Egypt, escaping, becoming refugees to escape the destructive power of a pompous, paranoid ruler. And Paul, in the piece from Galatians that we read, Paul, his letters predate the Gospels by about 20 years, and in his letter, he's taking pains in his letter to show how ordinary and Jewish Jesus' birth and upbringing was. When the fullness of time came, God sent his Son, born of a woman, like you do, born under the law, like you do, in order to redeem those who were under the law so that we might receive adoption as children. If Paul had heard anything about Luke's or Matthew's birth narratives, the virgin conception, the message from the angels, the visits from the Magi, all that stuff, Paul would have been crying it out from the rooftops in his preaching. It's only Luke's gospel that gives us this quick hint in today's reading of the complicated daily reality of raising the Christ child in a family of poor Jewish peasants on the backwater edge of the Roman Empire. He's the one who gives us a quick snapshot of the business of becoming a family, of figuring out how to keep this new baby fed and warm and healthy in a dangerous and cold world. And you get this mix of the perfectly ordinary business as usual that followed the Christmas evening, combined with occasional strange goings on. Part of Mary and Joseph's business as usual in Luke's gospel is, after Jesus is born in Bethlehem and before they go back to their hometown in Nazareth, they're only a day's journey from Jerusalem. And so on the eighth day, as the Torah commands, they took the short hike to the big city, to the temple, to present him to the Lord and to offer a sacrifice for Mary's purification after childbirth. This is nothing out of the ordinary. This is what all devout Jewish parents who were a reasonable distance from Jerusalem did after their children were born. Important detail, if you go to the Torah to see what the required sacrifice was, it was a sheep or a goat, unblemished. But there's a loophole for the poorest of the poor that they could substitute a pair of turtle doves, which they would buy from the traders that Jesus would have a run-in with in another 30 years or so. It's the offering of the poor, people who didn't have the money to spend on a proper lamb for the offering. There would have been some words from the priest, a few prayers, and Mary and Joseph would finally be on their way back to the tiny, tiny village of Nazareth, back to their home together, to Joseph's carpentry business, well, tectone business, we're not sure what that is. He could have been a stoneworker, handyman, any number of things. Back to business as usual, except not with this baby. Different things were bound to happen once in a while. I don't have a good segue for the next bit here, but I'll just jump in. I don't know if I've shared this with too many of you, but my brother Jeff is a set dresser in Hollywood. A set dresser. Whenever you see things like key grip and all those weird things at the end of the credits, you'll see my brother's name in there once in a while. He does set design and setup and breakdown for movies and TV shows, from Stargate and Die Hard 2 to Agent Carter and Masters of Sex. I understand that was a very good TV series about Masters and Johnson, right? I think, yeah. His now ex-wife is an Emmy and Oscar award-winning makeup artist. They live in a very different world than Barb and I do. And each of us think we are definitely in the right one. But I remember when he was still fairly new, it was about 16 years ago, he called me up and he was freaking out about an event when he was, they were having a birthday party for their four-year-old son, Liam, out on the beach. They were in an apartment, then across the highway, and then there's the beach. And they had invited all the moms in the apartment building where they lived. And they didn't know any of them, really, but they knew who dragged toddlers around, so they put invites on them. And so all these women and kids start gathering and mingling out on the beach, and my brother said he was having this weird deja vu thing going on because there's all these, it just feels like he's met all of them before. And then he realized that all of them were semi-employed actresses in movies and TV shows. So he's like, you're the substitute teacher from Saved by the Bell, and you're that secretary in that one episode of The Cosby Show. So you had here a couple of dozen quite attractive, mostly blonde, vaguely familiar women who dart in and out of our pretend TV watching world into our TV watching lives in 10-second chunks. Only at the birthday party were they, you know, really there and able to carry on conversations and carry sand-covered toddlers like ordinary mortals do. In movies, there are a couple of ways that people pop in and out quickly. One is called a cameo role. Now, a cameo role is where a well-known person has a small, non-speaking, and often unpaid and uncredited part. Alfred Hitchcock is really well known for having a cameo role in most of his films. And part of the fun in even in a scary Alfred Hitchcock film, part of the fun is waiting to find out where and when Hitchcock's going to show up. Marvel Comics guru Stan Lee shows up in many of the Marvel superhero movies now. Sometimes subtly, sometimes not so subtly. Senator Patrick Leahy has showed up in three films in cameos, including the Batman film The Dark Knight, the only proper Batman film. And in the newest Star Wars film, The Last Jedi, who's seen it? Man, people. Okay, in the newest Star Wars film, there's a bunch of celebrity cameos, but a lot of them we don't see because they're behind stormtrooper helmets and stuff. So Prince William and Prince Harry are stormtroopers who are about to execute Finn and Rose. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is an alien named Slow and Low, which is a takeoff, I understand, on a rap song, the title. But he's this alien who's cranky about where Finn and Rose have parked their space cruiser on the beach. All three of Mark Hamill's children play rebel fighters in the film. And I understand that there's a whole pile of actors from Game of Thrones that are showing up all over the place, who had tiny bits throughout the film. I've not ever seen Game of Thrones, so I wouldn't be able to tell you. But film geeks online are watching The Last Jedi over and over and over to get all the people that they know who are showing up in unexpected places. Those are cameos, in this case of the Westeros actors. So there's cameo roles. The other small bit is called a walk-on role. Now, a walk-on role is a small, non-speaking, often unpaid part, but not done by a well-known actor from somewhere else. These are done by nobodies, just folks. They're often local people who live in the location where the film is being done. And it's always wonderful when a film is filmed in Vermont, and you might even know the person who shows up, who walks into the general store or something. No film geeks will spend hours poring over the film to catch a walk-on, because there's no... They're nobody. They're just local characters of no import to anybody online. They're in no other TV shows. They're in no other films. Their only perk is 20 years later, they're going to be able to win the occasional bar bet that, oh yeah, I appeared for 2.5 seconds holding the door for Molly Ringwald in Pretty in Pink. doesn't do a whole lot. In a sense, that very long segue was to say that, in a sense, Anna and Simeon ought to be walk-on characters. They are wicked local nobodies. Well, maybe not nobodies, because everybody who ever went to the Temple Mount to have a nice quiet afternoon of prayer knew these people. They were the wacko old people who wouldn't shut up about this Messiah that's supposed to be coming. The crazy old homeless people who kept begging for alms at the entrance to the Gentile court and would not stop talking about the one to come, the one who is the hope for Israel. They would yell it out to all who would listen and to all who wouldn't listen, to all who would welcome those words of prophecy and those who were just like, can you mind? I'm here to worship. I don't want to hear prophecy. Their nattering on about the Messiah would interrupt the deep prayers of the pious, the poetic prayers of the scribes, the exacting prayers of the priests. I suspect when people back then thought of Anna and Simeon, they would have described them as tolerated more than they were celebrated. In a sense, Anna and Simeon's were walk-on local nobodies with a bit part to play in the drama that is the birth of Jesus Christ. Except that God is doing the casting here. And there are no walk-ons in God's casting. They are more than walk-ons, even more than cameos. In God's upside-down kingdom drama, Anna and Simeon play bigger and more crucial roles than do Herod or Caesar or Pilate or Caiaphas or any of the religious and political bigwigs that are in charge of the earthly kingdoms. And Anna and Simeon have speaking parts, which is very unusual in a walk-on or a cameo. They have prophetic words from the Holy Spirit that told deep, surprising, and uncomfortable words about how the mysterious ways of love incarnate would intersect and collide with our beautiful, ugly, hurting, sublime world so desperately in need of the redemption of God. There's a Catholic theologian, Mary Pozzulo, who wrote an essay about Simeon, putting his words into the context of the times. Simeon, the strange old crazy homeless guy, takes the baby Jesus in his arms and lifts him up and says, "Lord, now let your servant go in peace. Your word has been fulfilled. My own eyes have seen the salvation which you have prepared in the sight of every people, a light to reveal you to the nations, to the Gentiles, and the glory of your people Israel." Simeon is thrilled because his days of suffering are over. "Let your servant go in peace." I can die now, to put it colloquially. I can die in peace now because I know your promised one has come. But Mary Pozzulo writes this: Simon's suffering is over, but Mary's is only beginning. Simeon has no comforting words for her. "This child is destined to cause many in Israel to fall and many others to rise. He has been sent as a sign from God, but many will oppose him. As a result, the deepest thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul." Can you imagine 8 days after you've given birth to this gorgeous little creature? You've got some wild old man saying, "A sword will pierce your soul." This young innocent baby will be opposed by those in charge. It will cause the fall of many in Israel. Mary Pozzulo wrote, "It seems like gratuitous cruelty, but it's only the truth. It's not going to be all right. Not for a very long time. The worst is far from over for her." Pozzulo also writes a paragraph about how, in some ways, what Mary is hearing is true for every mother. To bear a child, she writes, is the most terrible responsibility. A mother gives birth knowing that because her child is alive, her child is going to suffer. Her child is going to know suffering and disappointment and loss and trauma, and someday her child is going to die. That just is reality. Giving birth means becoming the mother of a creature that is doomed to die. So it is, she writes, for every mother, even more so for Mary. Her soul is pierced, we're told. Another older person grabs her child, lifts him up, and shares with all who would listen, "This is the one, the promised one to come, Anna, the prophet." difficult words for Mary, difficult words for the world, and amazing words for us who put our whole trust in this babe from Bethlehem. And it's a crucial calling for those of us who claim to follow him. Just a few things to bring home. This reading shows us that God seldom works with and through the folks in power. The folks in the Kremlin, the folks in the White House, the folks on Wall Street. God works through the ordinary folk. The people who feel like their whole lives are walk-on. Older folks, poor folk, people on the edge of nowhere. That's where God shows up. And second, and I'm always nervous about quoting Woody Allen anymore, there's all these great quotes of people who are somewhat disgraced now, but Woody Allen said, 90% of life is showing up. And I'll paraphrase saying, 90% of faith is showing up. Anna and Simeon show that it is the daily, steadfast, sometimes annoying, showing up at the temple, paying attention, living fully awake and aware of how God is moving in the world. That is a truer spirituality than the pious poetry of pastors and priests, where divinity degrees get in the way of a true spirituality, because we think it requires really fancy words that we paid a lot of money for. It's the ordinary showing up every day, being awake and aware, that is true spirituality. And that even though we may feel like our lives are a series of walk-on roles, there will be times that the words we are called to speak are spirit-sparked and God-breathed. And the people will hold, and the people we hold, and the people we lift up maybe the ones God has placed there to change the world. One of my favorite poets, I know it's a favorite poet of several of you, is a woman named Mary Oliver, who hesitates to call herself a theologian, but I think she's a hell of a theologian. She's a poet of deep spiritual maturity. And for her, spirituality is about seeing the divine in the ordinary. I'm jealous so often because she will describe a scene that I could see out my front window every morning. And she sees the reality of God popping out in every snowflake, every leaf reflecting the sun. And I look at that scene and I go, oh, Lord, I need coffee. She's got a more mature spirituality than I do. But she wrote this. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. It is in the ordinary and the everyday where God breaks in and brings delight and also brings in hard good news that will pierce our hearts with a sword. Our job is to be present and awake and alive in our ordinary lives. And that is how we birth the Christ in our lives and into our world today. Learning to be astonished by where God is showing up. Amen.